Blog Talk Radio.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. Today we have an exciting show. We're going to have a great discussion here with Brother Umar R. Abdullah Johnson, President of the National Movement to Save Black Boys, nationally certified school psychologist, kinsman to Frederick Douglass, and Pennsylvania certified school principal. Welcome, Brother Umar. How are you today?
Thank you, brother. Some peace and blessings. It's an honor to be with you, and I thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome. And there's some pressing issues in the community that we love to discuss here, and that's why we are here. Which is about post-traumatic slave disorder. There's been a lot of discussion going around about it, but some people still have some difficulty understanding how the trauma that we've gone through and are still passing down these transgenerational, social behaviors and psycho illnesses. Could you tell us more about what is PTSD or post-traumatic slave disorder?
Definitely I will. Post-traumatic slave disorder refers to psychological, emotional, and behavioral traits that are exemplified and demonstrated by the descendants of enslaved Africans in the United States that works against their best interests as a people. Post-traumatic slavery disorder refers to trauma. It refers to the emotional and intellectual debilitating impact that in physical and emotional incarceration had upon us as a people. When we talk about post-traumatic slavery disorder, we are basically stating that black people have been psychologically engineered by white people to self-destruct and undermine their own progress.
Yes. Now, how can we treat this particular condition?
The problem with all mental disorders, be it post-traumatic slavery disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder, be it depression or bipolar personality issues, or whether it be, bipolar disorder or borderline personality issues. The problem with all mental issues is that you can only treat them with the participation of the patient. The patient has to want to get better. That's the chief problem with overcoming post-traumatic slavery disorder, because number one, you have to admit you have it. And number two, you have to be willing to do something about it. First of all, black people, many of us, will not admit that we have something that is fundamentally wrong with our mindset. And number two, most of us are not willing to do anything to change that incarcerated consciousness that we have, because we actually think it's working. And the reason we think it's working is because we have cars and houses and education. It looks like it's working because we have been able to acquire a certain degree of European materialistic garbage, and we judge our success based on what we own. We don't judge our success based on what we control.
Excellent. That's a serious problem, because we do believe that having material, you could say, white products produced by a European society is a measurement of maturity or competency. But, you know, how do we know if we have it?
Well, when you talk about post-traumatic slavery disorder, you're referring to a collective diagnosis. You're not talking about individuals. You are talking about diagnosing an entire group of people. Slavery was done to an entire group of people. It was not done to individuals. So anybody who belongs to that group of people is automatically and necessarily a victim of post-traumatic slavery disorder as well. In other words, there can be no I and they when you talk about collective illness. There can only be a we. And since all black people in America have been subject to the same treatment, exactly the same treatment, at the hands of the ASO, or the American Social Order, none of us can claim not to have been affected by post-traumatic slavery disorder. In fact, Brother Charles, the denial of the syndrome is the greatest piece of evidence we have to prove that it exists. For example, if you were locked in a trunk for 5 days without food or without air, and somehow you managed to make it with some air, because obviously you wouldn't get that far, but if you got out of that trunk, you went through some trauma, particularly a child. An adult can probably stay in the trunk for 5 days, but a child would be traumatized. I know this because I worked with a child who was locked in a trunk for several days. That's trauma. If a woman was sexually abused consistently, okay, on and off for a couple of weeks, there's going to be trauma. If a woman was sexually violated, just one instance of sexual violation is going to bring trauma. So how in the hell does an entire group of people come to believe that they suffer no aftershock, no psychological aftershock after having been traumatized, abused, raped, exploited, and dehumanized, not for a day, not for a couple hours, not for a few months, but for 243 years. To deny that you are dealing with the aftershock of trauma is to admit your own sickness anyway.
Exactly. There's no way ever. We have the negrocracy, or the black aristocracy, and they oftentimes brag amongst themselves about how they own African slaves as well. And so they make pretense as though they don't have any such syndrome to manifest in their lives, and they're okay. They think they're well-adjusted and properly adapted to society, and we should just all get on with it and copy them. But, you know, But for the rest of us, you know, who, you know, don't have that perspective along with them, why are we in denial about it?
Give me that question again, Brother Charles. I'm sorry.
Why are the regular people like you and I, who don't claim membership to the black bourgeoisie, are in denial about post-traumatic slave disorder?
Well, remember now, because we're all affected by it and denial is the first stage of resistance to any significant change, we're all going to be in denial about it, because if you can deny it, that automatically concludes that you don't want to do anything about it. See, the reason why black people fundamentally deny most of our issues, whether we're talking about psychological problems like post-traumatic slavery disorder, or economic problems such as the lack of independent institutions, or political problems such as the lack of organized blocks of black voters who vote in order to change situations, not to get people elected into office, all of our problems can be reduced to denial. It's not that we don't know that something wrong is going on. It's that we don't care enough to want to do anything about it. And the best way to prevent from having to do anything about any problem is to deny its existence. Even when we deny the existence of our problems, Brother Charles, we're really denying it because we don't want to do anything about it. When we are alone by ourselves and we begin to think and analyze what's going around, you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who can't tell something's wrong with the black experience and the black agenda in America. But because black people don't love themselves more than white supremacy hates us, we stay stuck and stagnated. Now, the black aristocracy, they have a very, very central role in the oppression of black people, because it is through the black face that the white face operates. It is through the black face that the white face operates. So the American social order is able to control the masses of black people by using the black aristocracy to miseducate, misinform, and mislead them. So Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, they are very, very important weapons in the arsenal of white supremacy, because it is these Negro leaders who misinform the already undereducated black masses into believing that they have made progress simply because someone has said so, And secondly, because they see certain black people who have elevated themselves into certain places. And thusly, the success of one person automatically becomes the success of all people, which is one of the greatest pieces of propaganda, false propaganda, that black people have been sold. I am not better off because you are better off. I am only better off when we all are better off. And until we all are better off, none of us are better off.
I mean, that is so true, because I know people who they may have a better income than someone else, and if you ask them, do they have any influence to make some changes in the society, and they always say, I can't do nothing about that. I'm barely, you know, they mention how impotent they are to make social changes happen. So these people are obsessed with their own, I guess, alienated concept of success and or stability, and which makes them not want to protect the society. They don't even want to protect their own children, their relatives, which makes the whole society weak, and we have difficulty, I guess, properly educating our young to the point that we can prepare a new generation to bring us out of this situation, to let's say admit that we have an illness, this post-traumatic slave syndrome or disorder, and we could eventually begin some type of begin to take some type of academic measures. Like one of the things I've heard you mention on occasion was a psycho-academic war against black boys.
Right.
Could you go into that in some detail, in particular, what is psycho-academic war against black boys?
Very much so. The psycho-academic war against black boys is a deliberate system, a five-stage system of extermination that the American social order has designed and developed and has implemented in order to see to it that most black males are killed by the time they reach the age of 30. The first step is miseducation. Miseducation consists of three primary goals. Number one, to teach the black boy to hate himself. Number two, to teach the black boy to love white culture. And number three, to, if possible, to effeminize or homosexualize the black boy. We'll get back to that. Stage number two, psychiatric medication. When the black boy does not consent to having his spirit broken or his manhood stripped, if he does not consent to be emasculated at the hands of a white female teacher, then they automatically resort to drugging his brain to force complicity in the miseducation. Number three becomes incarceration. When the black man does not allow himself to be miseducated, when the black boy refuses the psychiatric medication, in other words, if he resists the incarceration of the mind through drugs, he then is forced, okay, to accept incarceration of the body through jail. And once he comes out of jail, he normally has a prison record, which makes it difficult for him to go back to public school, as most states have enacted laws that prevent boys who have been arrested, or girls for that matter, who have been arrested, to return to their local public school. That feeds the dropout rate, which feeds crime. Okay, and so now he has a prison record whereby he cannot obtain employment or get a decent education. He's forced to participate in the economic underworld in order to feed himself and his family, which unfortunately ultimately leads to his homicide, which is stage five, extermination. Okay, stage four was the frustration and isolation that our young men experience after they come out of jail with no alternatives or resources, and stage five is the extermination. So those are the five stages within the psychoacademic war against black boys. Now, a minute ago you mentioned how we can change our problem. And to change our problem is to do what? Educate and prepare an entire new generation of African children who would be equipped and prepared, you know, to restore us to our ancient glory. Why isn't that happening? We have had, okay, about three or four generations of black children since the Civil Rights Movement. Three or four generations, and we're still not where we're supposed to be as a people. Why is that? It's because we are sending those children to the very same people who were responsible for our enslavement. We are sending those same children to the very same people who are responsible for the psychoacademic war. We're sending our children to the same people who are responsible for the homosexual assault against black youth. So we are going to continue to be going backwards into the future until we accept the responsibility of educating our own children, which is something that black people are absolutely not interested in doing. There are few and far in between independent black private schools. Why? Because black people do not have a commitment to themselves. And if you don't have a commitment to yourself, that logically follows that you do not have a commitment to your children as well.
That is so poignant, because I had been talking about the commitment to a devotion, really, to one's community in every respect. And it is so evident that somehow between the era of segregation and complete integration of the public school system, that our people began to get the notion that there was no social responsibility to educate and properly socialize our children to be responsible and accountable for their actions in terms of building and strengthening the community. I know you can elaborate that at length, and I do want you to do that. And I want to digress into a point you mentioned earlier about the white female teacher bringing some type of trauma to the child, because I had experience with a white female teacher in the second grade where my mother recalls, I had it forgotten, but she told me that I saw her call an actual rival student that I was even at odds with at times. She called him a nigger in class. And I was upset about it, that's when I first began to be aware that there was some ethnic hostility from white people towards us. I don't know how much I knew before that time, because I never spent much time around Caucasians. But that one, being one of my earliest memory, first memory with Caucasians, I saw that hostility, and I understood that those people, especially that white female, she hated people of African descent. And here's an interesting thing I would like to ask is, can a white female teachers teach black boys? Can you elaborate on that?
Okay. In order to answer that question, the first question we have to ask ourselves is, what is the purpose of education? Because the only way to determine whether or not someone can complete a job is to first define that job. So what is the purpose of education? If the purpose of education is simply to teach a child how to read, how to write, and how to do arithmetic, yes, the white teacher can teach a black boy. But if the purpose of education is to prepare that black man as a warrior, okay, as a political, economic, social, militaristic warrior whose sole responsibility in life is to give that life for the redemption of African people, she absolutely cannot teach him. Why? Because her livelihood rest upon his degradation. And you cannot expect anyone to have more investment in another people than they have in their own people. So if we simply want basic academic skills to be taught, sure, a white woman can do that, although we see that there's very little evidence to suggest they can even do that well. Okay, but if the job is to prepare him for an African revolution, she absolutely has no business trying to teach him. Now, the other thing that we have to recognize is the reason why we are having so much trouble getting white women to teach our boys how to read, write, and do math is because they don't care about our children. You cannot expect someone who does not care about your race to want to preserve that race by properly educating its youth. White people have a fundamental contempt for black people, and thereby they do not invest themselves sufficiently to be able to teach our children. And that's why as soon as a black boy begins to struggle, as soon as he begins to struggle, they automatically refer him to special education. Why? Because they do not want to be bothered.
You know, that's very succinctly put. Because Dr. Amos Wilson, in his book, The Developmental Psychology of the Black Child, he discusses the retardation measures that this white society places upon the black child in order to create the intellectual and other cultural advantages for white and other ethnic groups to retard our development so that we cannot be, or at least reach our highest potential, our fullness. So, you know, why are white and Asian children outperforming black children, if you will?
Well, number one of the reasons why they outperform black children is because white female teachers who run our schools do not have a natural aversion to their own children, and they do not have a natural aversion to Asian children who benefit from the stereotype of being the most intelligent, okay? So there's no natural aversion to them, okay? That's number one. They are comfortable teaching white children because they are their own, and they're comfortable teaching Asian children because they will make the white teacher look better because of their commitment to education. The reason Asian children outperform everybody else is because they are more committed to their education than everybody else, okay? The average Asian child spends about 15 hours a week studying outside of school. The average white kid spends about 8 to 12 hours a week studying outside of school, and the average black kid only spends about 45 minutes a week studying outside of school, okay? Our children have the least academic commitment, especially our boys, and the reason why that is because we don't instill academic commitment to our children. The average black boy is running around thinking he's going to be an athlete or an entertainer. Okay? That's his entire future. I'm going to run up and down a football field, a basketball court, entertaining white people for the rest of my life. Okay? And unfortunately, many black men reinforce this nonsense in the minds of their sons. I'm not saying that we should steal their dreams. I'm simply saying that we should make sure they are realistic about their future opportunities, because only 1% out of all high school athletes will ever turn pro. Only 1%. So I'm not going to stop my son from pursuing a career in professional athletics, but he's going to make sure that he does well academically, because if he is not successful in becoming a professional athlete, he will have to fall back on his education in order to sustain himself and his family. So we don't have to steal the dream from them. We just have to make sure that there's a viable alternative in case they're not successful. But we also have to blame the educated black man for this as well. We can't fault our boys for naturally wanting to be that, which appears to be the only career that a black man can actually succeed in without going to jail or suffering an enormous amount of resistance from white racism. The only successful black men that our boys see are athletes and entertainers, because most educated black men run for the white suburbs as soon as they get a good job and get a good education. And many of them run to the white suburbs with a white woman. So our boys are only replicating or duplicating what they see. If we want to change that, then we need to make sure that more black men are available in the inner cities to serve as role models.
You know, excellent point. You mentioned the statement about the white and Asian teachers not having a natural aversion to teaching their young. I would definitely like to explore that. Like I learned something about these charter schools where they have a special types of instructors. Could you tell me, are charter schools the solution to this type of issue?
No, charter schools are not. And the reason why charter schools are not the solution is because charter schools are still a part of the American social order. Have some charter schools done a good job of giving black children an alternative place to learn? Yes, they have. But charter schools come a dime a dozen. And, you know, some charter schools are worse than the elementary schools that they were intended to replace. So you have to study charter schools. In fact, I found in my work that your black child, your son, is more likely to be put in special education in a charter school than he is in a regular school. And the reason why that is because everybody is trying to get some money from the special education hustle. And as a result of that, black boys who have been miseducated from kindergarten through third grade are being put in special education in the fourth grade because nobody wants to put forth the extra effort to teach them. And also because you get money for putting children in special ed. Special education is a business. And because charter schools cannot to be subject to the extra grant money that public schools get. The only extra funding that a charter school is guaranteed to get is special ed funding. So, yes, your black son is more likely, I said more likely, to be put in special ed in a charter school because they need the money.
Wow. That's something, because I've worked in the school system for a few years, and I did notice the dependency on all of the monies that are made available by having children labeled with special, let's say, learning disabilities or behavioral. We're back with Brother Umar Johnson. Hello, Brother Umar.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, and we left off. We were discussing all these designations that school system psychology have labeled for the children, and special monies that the districts and the campuses get for the children being placed on various types of narcotics and whatnot. Can you tell us about the special education program and why is special ed necessary? Why is it, recommended or trying to be imposed upon students, and why is it here?
Certainly. Well, firstly, the school doesn't get money for the child being put on psychiatric medicine. The psychiatrist, the pediatrician, the behavioral health center, the therapist, the clinical team gets money for the child being diagnosed, or should I say being put on the medicine. But
okay.
That's outside of school. But in school, they get money for putting them in special education. The psychotropic medication movement and the special ed movement are separate, but they're related. They're all a part of the psychoacademic war, but one functions primarily outside of school and the other functions primarily in school. However, most of our boys are referred for the medicine by their classroom teachers, which brings up a serious ethical issue because classroom teachers are not trained as psychologists or psychiatrists. Many of them get some introductory psychology courses, but they are not certified or licensed to be giving out professional mental health advice. But they do it. It is a big ethical issue. I also consider it a civil rights issue, but nobody's doing anything about the fact that public school teachers are giving parents expert mental health advice when they're not trained to do so. Now, special education, the process of labeling children with learning disabilities so they can get money or segregated from the regular classroom, has been in existence for 36 years. Special ed was created in 1975. The Education for All Handicapped Children Act of 1975, Public Law 94-142, 1975. So it's 36 years old. It's a 36-year-old failure. Special education was created as a compromise. And I want everybody to hear me well, because when you hear discussions on special education, you rarely hear the truth. Special education was created as a compromise between the United States government, who had to force integration, and the white racist school districts who resisted integration. In other words, the government had to force school districts to accept blacks. Why did they have to do that? Because it did not look good for foreign policy for the United States to be going into other countries under the disguise of being moral police and under the disguise of protecting human rights while they themselves were violating human rights domestically at home. It wasn't because they cared about black people, but until they solved the Negro problem at home, it would be difficult to play God in other countries. So they had to force white educators and white school districts and white parents to accept black children. As you know, integration was supposed to begin in 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education case of Topeka, Kansas, when the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that segregation had no role in public education. However, when you read some of the opinions of the justices in reference to the case, you will see that there was one justice in particular who said the reason he voted for integration wasn't because he wanted black kids to be with white kids, but because he felt that they could achieve their goals more effectively by integrating the children, which is a very, very powerful analysis by that European. So in 1954, when the Supreme Court passed that law, nobody listened. 10 years later, in 63, 64, we get the Civil Rights Act, which also calls for integration. But guess what? Hardly nobody listened again. So then we get 10 more years. Now we're at 1974. It's been 20 years of effort trying to integrate the schools, and nothing has been working. So what do? Brother Charles? They create special education. And what was it about special education that allowed white school districts to finally accept black children? It's because the federal government said, if you accept these black children, we will give you the right to diagnose them with a learning disability. Listen to me now. We will give you the right to resegregate the children. You can no longer segregate them because of color, but we will give you the right to segregate based on a learning disability whose existence you cannot prove. So we're going to let you resegregate the black kids. You can't say it's because they're black. You're going to have to say it's because they have a learning disability. And not only will we allow you to resegregate them, Brother Charles, we will give you money for resegregating them. That's how schools are through the special education package. Money for disabilities and labels and segregation.
I'm appalled that I'm just now learning it. I have relatives that are in the education, you know, a school. They went through that training, they got their degrees and taught and retired. And this is my first time hearing the true purpose of special education. And I've known people who work in it. I know friends who graduated and got, in education, got their undergraduate, and no one understood it. Or if they did, they didn't say anything. Wow. So, I mean, that this is explaining so much. It is so clear to me now how this diabolical plan has been enforced to, for the handicap or to retard our development in just another way. Another one, weapon in their arsenal. Wow. So, why are so many black boys getting, recommended and approved, whatever, for special education? And I guess maybe in contrast to black girls or what have you, could you elaborate on that for us?
Oh, without a doubt. See, remember now, with most psychological diagnoses, whether it be special education, which is school psychology, or whether it be clinical psychology, which is ADHD, depression, and all that stuff you diagnose outside of a school, you can't objectively prove the presence of a psychological disorder. Some of them you can. Schizophrenia can be proven under a microscope. Autism to some degree under a microscope. You know, someone who has been severely depressed for years, you can often, look at their brain and they manifest a different sort of biological functionality. But most psychiatric disorders cannot be proven objectively. You basically make your decision or determination based on what you see, what you hear, what you're told. Okay, which can be misleading. So people are misdiagnosed all the time. And the reason that so many black kids are in special education, Brother Charles, is because you can't prove whether or not they have a learning disability. And because you cannot prove it, it's simply a professional opinion made by the white school psychologist testing your son. Okay, then a black parent who's undereducated or a black person who believes everything white people say is the absolute truth, when they come and tell you that your son has a learning disability and needs special ed, you're not going to resist their words. You're going to accept what they said as gospel truth because they are white. And so we have so many black kids going in special ed because, number one, you can't prove that they have a learning disability in the first place. And number two, black parents are willing to accept anything that white people tell us about our children. PTSD, and it's getting out of control. It is absolutely getting out of control. You can go into some schools where nearly every boy is in special ed and on medicine. So they're being doped up and miseducated at the same time. The teacher is sending the mother to the clinical psychiatrist or psychologist to get an ADHD diagnosis. They get a prescription for Ritalin, Adderall, Strattera, Cyclope, Prozac. The list goes on. Okay, and now they're being doped up. Now, what is the difference between these drugs and the illegal street drugs that are sending black men to jail by the hundreds of thousands? Absolutely nothing, Brother Charles. The same toxicity, the same side effects, and they basically function for the same reason. Why does a drug addict use drugs? To escape their problems through getting high. Why are children being given drugs? Okay, to intoxicate their brains to the point where they no longer have control over their behavior, okay? And so you definitely do what? Arrest the brain. You dumb the brain down so much that the body can't function, and that's how they make your child be still. That's how they make them be still, by putting on the brakes on the whole brain. And that's why there's so many side effects that come with these drugs. You know, they kill brain cells, heart problems, tics, tremors, delusions, hallucinations, premature ejaculation, messes with sperm count, and a whole bunch of other problems, you know. So you're not solving anything by putting the child on drugs. You're not solving anything by putting the child in special education. Special education ain't fixed nobody. Ritalin ain't fixed nobody. But we continue to do it. Why? Because we're being told by white people that this is what our children need.
Wow. I mean, it's so credible. I mean, to see it, because we know their history and what the things they do, but it's just amazing how our society is so complicit. We go along, you know, black society is so naive or just complicit. We'll go on, we'll comply with whatever the predator wants. He's offering candy, and we keep getting in the car every time to get molested, and it happens every day to us.
Every day.
And it's like we're not learning to don't trust strangers with candy. I'm just having some difficulty processing our people's collective behavior here. Whoa. I mean, could you go more into the psychotropic medications and the reactions in the brain or whatever, and get into how, you know, it interferes with, I believe, serotonin uptake and makes people, I guess, chemically dependent?
Very much so. Well, all of the drugs, you know, all the psychiatric drugs are designed to produce an addiction anyway. They're designed to produce an addiction, because remember, behind racism lies capitalism. And that's not to say that capitalism caused racism, because it did not, although many black socialists would argue that point. It's incorrect. Racism would exist whether you had capitalism or not. However, in the American social order, because it is based on profit, it's based on white supremacy, and it's based on white profit. White supremacy and white capitalism. And because of that, any problem that's created for black people must automatically draw profit for white investors. We have to be clear about this. So whenever you see a problem for black people, whether it's mass incarceration, whether it's special education, psychotropic drugs, miseducation, the destabilization of the black family, who profits from it? Because no problem gets attention in this society unless you can make money off of it. So we have to be very clear about that. So when we talk about the psychiatric drugs, we're talking about Wall Street corporations, Brother Charles. Wall Street corporations are producing the drugs. They make about $50 billion a year from producing the drugs. They make $50 billion a year from producing these drugs. And they use that $50 billion a year to do what? Influence the American Psychiatric Association, influence the American Psychological Association, influence the Food and Drug Administration, influence the National Research Council, influence your presidential candidates, influence your congressional candidates, influence your state legislatures, influence your community-based organizations who they also give grant money to. These same companies that are brain-drugging our boys are also funding our community-based organizations, okay? And that is another issue that we have in the black community. We are often funded by the same people who are trying to kill us because black people are so damn greedy for a dollar that we will take that dollar from anybody without first investigating how they make that dollar. I'll give you a good example. Many of the banks in the black community, not to get off task, but many of the banks in the black community that are financing the regentrification of the black community or the removal of blacks and the replacing of whites, many of those banks that are financing the loans for white people to come into our neighborhood and take it over are also funding the community-based organizations. They're funding the churches. They do this why? So they can use black faces in high places to turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to the oppression of the black masses. They have been doing this since the beginning of time. You will find some of the worst races in American history have funded black causes. Why would a racist be interested in funding a black cause? Because when you do that, black people become complicit in your program, and as a result of that, they never let other black people know who you are and what exactly you're doing in the community. As the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey said, you cannot use your enemy's money to undermine your enemy. White people are not as disorganized as black people are. We tend to think that what you can do to us, you can do to other people, Brother Charles, and that is not the case. You cannot use white people to destroy white people. You can't do it. You cannot. I don't care how greedy and money-hungry white people are. Their first obligation is to the perpetuation of their species. That's first. So you hear black people say, if we had the money, we could pay some white people to help us undo white people. That's a damn lie. There's a white person on earth you're going to be able to pay to help undo other white people. You can't do it. You can only pay black people to undo other black people because our racial glue, our cultural unity, our commitment to each other has been destroyed through slavery. And we have not put forth the mental concentration and effort necessary to restore the destruction of our unity. That's why the black conscious organizations spend just as much time fighting as the brothers on the corner do. And that's why the black churches spend just as much time competing with each other as the black gangs do. Why do you see no difference in the relationship amongst black people in the conscious community versus in the hood? There's no difference in the way we relate to each other because there's no difference in consciousness. There's only a difference in knowledge. We simply know more than them. We're not more conscious because when you are more conscious, then your behavior takes a change, Brother Charles. You begin to do something different. Black people who consider themselves black nationalists or cultural nationalists, I personally consider myself a pan-African nationalist, but for the cultural nationalists and the black nationalists and the Moors and the Hebrews and the conscious Muslims, conscious Christians, this group, that group, this group, if you look at them, Brother Chuck, they don't behave any differently than the so-called unconscious people. Why? Because we all suffer from the same essential illness, post-traumatic slavery disorder. And you cannot get rid of post-traumatic slavery disorder by reading a book, by going to Africa, by learning how to speak Egyptian, by practicing African religion, by wearing dashikis, by locking your hair, by changing your name. None of that garbage does anything to post-traumatic slavery disorder. Why? Because post-traumatic slavery disorder is a mental condition. We have been conditioned to think, feel, and behave the way that we do. So the only way to get rid of a condition is to uncondition it. And the only way to uncondition post-traumatic slavery disorder is through self-directed, what I call, self-directed mental reconstruction therapy. It must be self-directed. Because nobody knows exactly how sick you are except you. So it must be self-directed, and it must be mental recondition therapy, where you deliberately and consciously seek to do what? remove all of your unconscious Negro habits that have been put into you by white people by virtue of post-traumatic slavery disorder. And in order to get rid of those unconscious habits, Brother Charles, we have to be able to do what? Locate them and isolate them and then eliminate them. Just like you change a bad physical habit, you can change a bad mental habit. If you have a habit of looking at black people as being less than human, you can change that by looking at black people as being the ultimate humans, and at the same time, the speech and negative information you receive about your people. So this is a personal journey, Brother Charles. It is essentially a personal journey that we each have to make, but it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of concentration, and a lot of motivation to do what? Take the time necessary and put forth the energy necessary to pay attention to everything you think, feel, or do in an effort to change it. Why? Because our egos are naturally invested in trying to get us to believe that the way we are is the way we always need to be. So to force the ego, okay, to get out of the way so you can deal with all of your shortcomings is a very difficult thing to do. That's why people stay on drugs all their lives. That's why people stay depressed all their lives. That's why people suffer from personality disorders all their lives. That's why people suffer from anxiety problems all their lives. And that's why most black people suffer from post-traumatic slavery disorder all their lives, because we do not have the mental discipline necessary to make the unconscious conscious, and after making it conscious, get rid of all that filth and sickness and unhealthy beliefs that white folk have conditioned into our ancestors and that they have passed down to us.
You know what? That was a great a reprise back to that treatment therapy, because we got so many people, like you said, in the conscious community, you know, they're studying somewhat. I don't know how much, but it appears to me that whatever it is they're studying, it's like they're studying to prove that they're better than the next man that's not
in this, go to school.
In that same thing. He'll study, like, if you read one book and another guy's reading another book, he'll say, you need to read this book that I'm reading. Like, you
hey,
know.
Yes,
and I'll say, I'm reading this book. I'm not just, both books should be read, but the guy's saying, basically, the book that I'm reading is more important to read than the book that you're reading. Unless he's read it already.
That's right. You hit the ball on the head. The reason why,
you know, and I was like, I see this. I run the brothers all the time where we talking, whatever, and it's always this. It's like you see the elitism all over again. You know, they always say, oh, that's the wrong thing to even know. You shouldn't even know that. You know, you should know what I know, and then we can argue and fight about who knows the most out of the knowledge that we all are trying to learn. You know, it's like it's constantly subdividing into these infinitesimal par divisions that there is no end to it. So, and then these same people, when you're talking to them about traumatic disorders or that they're manifesting in their personality, they don't want to address those. They'll try to talk about somebody else that has it. Oh, yeah, that guy, he did it. What about you? They don't say, they don't say, but some people do try to address some of them. But it is very uncommon that you see them people say, yes, I used to hate on my friends and relatives when I learned things, and now I've learned to not do that, and I've learned to be comfortable with other people learning. I share what I have and to learn to appreciate what other people are doing to try to improve their situation. That is the most rare social interaction that I could say I probably have ever had, and I've had maybe a couple, two, three. But it's not a common thing in the conscious society, which we need to see more of. And so, like, you know, I guess we can really direct that also into our relationships, like you say, with each other and into male-female relationships. One thing I noticed is that even in the conscious community, our relationship, I guess, male-female dynamic is mirroring that which is in the so-called, I guess, the unconscious community. We should have improved our relationships with our women folk and then the people who are not conscious. But it seems to me that we haven't made the transformation to significant, you know, like you said, address stop denying our illness with this post-traumatic slave syndrome and being able to address those things so they can eradicate these personality disorders and be able to have holistic relationships with our black women. And so one of the things I want to touch on is why is the divorce rate so high in our community? Could you address that for us, please?
Sure. Black people fundamentally suffer from self-hatred, deliberately engineered psychologically to self-destruct and work against their best interests. That's not limited to our collective progress. That also deals with our family, our relationship to our children, our relationship to our parents, our siblings, our next-door neighbors. The entire black community is dysfunctional and self-hating. So naturally, that will extend down into the family. But within the family, we even have a greater situation that we're dealing with, Brother Charles, because the European, since slavery, has deliberately sought to upset the natural gender balance and harmony within the black household. And so what he did was he deliberately effeminized and emasculated the black man. And at the same time, he deliberately masculinated the black woman. In other words, he made her into a man and made the man into a woman. And that natural upsetting of the natural masculine-feminine principle balance in our household has continued to wreak havoc in our relationships all the way down to the 21st century. See, that's why you see so many black women being given opportunities to go to college and advance their education. Black women are in higher paid and more prestigious positions than black men are. Black men are deliberately miseducated, marginalized, sent to jail, and exterminated. While at the same time, black women are the ones who are given the opportunities to go to college and succeed. Not to say that they don't face racism, because they do. They don't like black women any more than they like black men. I want to be clear. They're simply using her as a strategy to destroy the whole race by first destabilizing the male. So when we come home, that becomes a problem because the black woman now feels that she has a right to control her man. In other words, she now believes she is the head of the household and that he's simply her wife because she has greater education and greater income. In other words, she has allowed the indoctrination by the American social order to affect the way she thinks and ultimately undermine her relationship with her man. That's a very big issue in our relationships. But we also see the other thing happening, where black men believe because of their education, they believe because of their income, that they have the right to mistreat their woman because there's so few black men out here, so they believe they have the right to treat her any kind of way she wants. No matter how you look at it, we are looking at the lessons that white people are giving us, and we are using them against each other, and it's destroying our household. The she-male phenomenon is significant, Brother Charles. The she-male phenomenon, and that's S-H-E, she, hyphen male, she-male. A she-male is a black female who has the consciousness of a white alpha male. She has a woman's body and the mind of a white alpha male, and she interacts with her husband like a man. And as you know, two men cannot occupy the same space and time. Two lions can't rule the same bed. So one of them is going to have to submit or one of them is going to have to leave. And because we have the woman who has been engineered to function like a white man, the black man comes home and he now has to fight the white man in his house who is in the body of his own wife. And so we have to deal with that issue. Okay, we also have to deal with the greater problem, Brother Charles, of unhealthy black people getting married. Let me say that again. Too many psychologically, emotionally, unhealthy black people are getting married. And they're getting married for the wrong reasons, Brother Charles. They're getting married because they want somebody to make them feel better. They're getting married because they want somebody to make them happy. Nobody can make you happy. That is your own responsibility. All emotional states are internally generated. So if you want to change an emotional state, if you want to go from sadness to happiness, then you're going to have to work on yourself. We don't want to do that because we're too lazy. Just like we don't want to work on our own post-traumatic slave disorder, we don't want to work on our own unhappiness. We want to do what? Give that responsibility to somebody else. We want to give that responsibility to somebody else. We want them to make us happy. But guess what, Brother Charles? They can't do it. I can't make a woman happy. So guess what happens? After about a year in the marriage, she's no longer content. She wants out. or I want out, because it goes either way. I want to be clear. It goes either way. Okay, the man is as responsible as the woman, and the woman is as responsible as the man. So I give you about a year or two to make me happy. I notice that you're not making me happy. So what do I want to do? I want to get out of this situation as quickly as I can and find somebody else to make me happy. But it never happens. And that's why you hear about people being married 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times. People then cohabitated with 10, 12 different partners, because you're looking for an unrealistic expectation. You do not have the discipline and commitment to solve your own problems, so you want to give your problems to somebody else, and when they can't solve them, you blame them for being a bad mate. They weren't a bad mate. You were a bad mate, okay? And you're going to be a bad mate to everybody you meet until you recognize that your responsibility, the responsibility for being happy, lies with yourself and not with your partner. And until we stop trying to get other people to solve our problems through marriage, marriages will continue to be destroyed. Two mentally sick people cannot make a happy relationship.
That is, I mean, very, very succinct. And I'd like to address, so this is very interesting, we lead into why so many people cheat on their spouses. Because, you know, this is like they're not fulfilled in themselves. They pass off their responsibility to someone else, which could easily lead to this infidelity. So, you know, is that for us? Brother Umar?
Yes, sir.
Yes, could you please address that for us? Why some people cheat on their spouses?
Oh, indeed. Well, again, all cheating ultimately goes back to dissatisfaction. Now, I would never justify stepping out of one's relationship. However, you know, being a therapist, I can tell you that sometimes I see why it's done. I don't condone it. I don't accept it. But I see why it's done. Okay? Ultimately, it all comes down to dissatisfaction. Sometimes if a woman is not getting enough time, she's going to want a man to pay attention to her. She wants that masculine principle in her life to complete her feminine principle. And if you're falling short, she may seek the companion of someone else. The same thing happens with men. If a man feels that his wife is not being as supportive and compassionate of what he's trying to do and the racism that he's facing every day to meet the needs of his family, he might seek another sister who's going to validate his manhood or support him. You see, so sometimes the reasons people go outside of the relationship are legitimate, although they're not acceptable. But I find underneath all of that is what? Underneath all of that is what? An unaddressed psychological issue that we did not deal with prior to getting married. I'm going to go right back to that. Yes, on the surface, I'm cheating on my husband because he's not spending enough time with me. On the surface, I'm cheating on my wife because she's constantly tearing me down and emasculating me in front of my children. Okay, but let's dig deeper. Why can't she wait until you get home? Why can't you sit down and talk to her about the emasculation? It's because there's something deeper than that. The reason you're cheating is simply the outward manifestation of the problem. The inward manifestation of the problem, or the original sin or issue, is the fact that somebody expected something out of someone that they can't possibly give them, Brother Charles. It always goes back to that. It always goes back to that. For example, I look at the women I've met who've married men, not because they care for them or love them, but to get over a man who didn't want them, who moved on and got married. You follow me? Now she wants a divorce 2 years later, and she's blaming him. But, sweetheart, my good sister, you didn't marry him in the first place because he was a good mate. You married him to get over your pain that your first choice does not want you. Same thing happens with men. I'm telling you, the reason why the marriages aren't working is because we're coming together for all the wrong reasons.
That right on. Because
we're
supposed to be coming together to build a society. People, we look at ancient cultures when they practicing, let's say, polygyny, and those women, they understood that they building a nation. And today, people, they seeing all these various weird contests that they're having. Like you said, They're coming together for the wrong reason, trying to mask the pain from a previous relationship, home life, racism, economic, where racism creates all the other problems, social ills that we have. And now, you know, it appears that we have something like, I guess you could call it, you know, post-traumatic relationship disorder. So could you elaborate on, like, what is post-traumatic relationship disorder?
Certainly, post-traumatic relationship disorder is a psychological and emotional illness that people who have been in traumatizing relationships suffer from, many of them. It is when you have been through such a bad experience that you're so traumatized and so fearful of going through that experience again that you never give subsequent partners the opportunity to prove to you that they can be a good mate. For example, a woman who has been physically abused by a past lover or mate or husband, she's so paranoid about being hurt again. She's so traumatized that every man she meets, she misinterprets their physical behavior as being suggestive that he also wants to beat on them. Or if they had a daughter who was sexually violated by an ex-boyfriend, every man they date who looks at their daughter and says hi, they assume that he wants their daughter sexually. Men do the same thing. If they dated a woman who financially exploited them for their money, every woman they date who says, can you take me out to dinner, they automatically assume that, you know, she wants to use me for, you know, my money. If he was cheated on, you know, by a past girlfriend and she slept with somebody he knew and that traumatized him, every woman he dates subsequently, you know, he may believe that anytime she speaks to one of his friends that she automatically wants to have sex with him. The problem with post-traumatic relationship disorder, Brother Charles, is it denies your current partner their individuality. It denies your current partner their individuality. You give them no opportunity to prove to you who they are. You constantly are seeing them through the dirty, unhealthy glasses that you saw your past partner through, okay? In other words, the energy of that past partner is still with you, which means what? Which means you should not be dating. You should not be dating. If you're suffering from post-traumatic relationship disorder, that means you have not completely healed. And we have an issue where a lot of our brothers and our sisters, but particularly our sisters, Brother Charles, okay, are spending time, okay, getting into new relationships before they have healed psychologically and emotionally from the previous relationship. For example, women are internal. Women are internal, so when they make love to a man, a part of his energy is in them now. When you go from man to man, you have to give your womb time to heal. You have to give your heart and your soul time to heal. But when you have a dependent personality disorder where you absolutely need a man to validate you, or if you're a woman with low self-esteem or a man with low self-esteem, you're constantly running from relationship to relationship because you can't stand to be alone. So you're never happy because you don't give yourself time to choose the right partner. Any man will do, any woman will do, because anything will do except being by ourselves. And why do we not like to be by ourselves? The reason why we don't like to be by ourselves is because when we're by ourselves, Brother Charles, we're forced to think about our past. We're forced to sort out our problems. Our unconscious is constantly throwing snowballs at us about issues from our psycho history that need to be addressed that we don't want to address because it's too painful or it's going to take too much effort. And so what do? We keep repressing. We keep repressing. We keep repressing until we get married, and all of that psychic garbage that we repress, it blows up and flies into the face of our loved one, and the relationship is destroyed. It wasn't destroyed because of them. It was destroyed because of us and our unwillingness to order our psychological selves before we got married.
Mm-hmm.
In churches, the religious institutions are also at fault, Brother Charles, because all they care about is people getting married. Okay? You go into the mosque, they see a single black man who's a Muslim. They see a single black woman who's a Muslim. Okay, y'all make a good couple because y'all both Muslim. Or he's a Christian, you're a Christian, y'all both make a good couple because y'all both Christian. Not to mention that he's a domestic abuser. Not to mention that she's been sexually violated by men in the past. Okay, nobody's going to talk about that. But simply because they have the same religion, they're good to go. And then when they get married, she starts mistreating him. He starts mistreating her. That's what they do. The church then tells them that to get a divorce or to separate is against God's will. You have to stay together at all costs because that's the way God wants it. But her husband is beating her head in. But still, that's your husband, and you have an obligation to God to try to work it out. The problem with the church and the mosque is that they're overly optimistic. I don't have a problem with optimism, Brother Charles, but when optimism jeopardizes somebody's life, now we have a problem. Some people need to be divorced. Sometimes the best thing for the children is for the two of you to get divorced, because if you had no business being married in the first place, if you had no business being married in the first place, why in the hell am I going to try to make you stick together through thick and thin when I know the best thing for both of you is to separate?
So it sounds a lot like the churches are using the congregants as breeders for or mosque or synagogue breeders for new members.
Exactly. That's what they're using them for, because after all, okay, every pastor knows that his church is only as good as the amount of people coming and the amount of money they're giving.
Right. So, like, the both parents are in that particular spiritual construct. It's a high level of certainty that the children will follow suit, and they will be able to continue the, that tradition which they're in.
That's awesome. Right. Very much so.
And another thing about that optimism is, like, they don't have, like you said, facing our problems with and getting away from the denial with the post-traumatic slave disorder syndrome. You just keep denying it. Just stay together as long as you can. And I guess the whole society is all the sicker for it. You know, so, how can we build stronger relationships in our community?
Well, first of all, you got to fix the community. Another reason why divorces are so high in our community, Brother Charles, is because most black families who go through issues don't have anybody they can go to that they can trust. We don't have enough black psychologists, and even the ones who are black psychologists, many of them have a European mindset, and many of them don't do therapy. Remember, most psychologists don't do therapy. Only certain psychologists do therapy. Many of them train, they teach, they evaluate. They don't do therapy. So we are at a lack of people who can really help us with our relationships. That's number one. Number two, it's not that you necessarily need a therapist, okay? You just need somebody who is unbiased, you know, somebody with some wisdom, you know, and some understanding, you know, who can then talk to both of you honestly as a third party about what they're seeing in a relationship and what you need to do about it. The problem is many of us don't have people we can trust, you know what I mean? And so what happens, you start talking about your problems to somebody. Next thing you know, they're telling somebody else about your personal information. So that's a big problem, because black people don't know how to shut their damn mouth. As you know, we talk too much. You know,
yeah.
So finding somebody that we can trust and share our issues with. You know, finding somebody we can trust and share our issues with, you know, that's a real big problem. So we're suffering in silence, Brother Charles, because the black community is not healthy. Okay? What makes you healthy? You got to have healthy institutions that meet the needs of your people. Okay, you got to have a community is only as good as its institutions. We don't have
right.
any. All of our institutions are run by white people. We don't have any institutions that deal with our needs. And the so-called
right.
community-based organizations, all they're looking for is what? Grant money. They just want some money. All they want is some money, you know? And so our whole thing is we have to start building institutions. You know, we have to have a place men and women can go to when they have marital issues to work it on out. Because sometimes it can be worked out. And if it can't be worked out, then we have to let them know, you know what, it's best for y'all to go ahead and separate because this is too far. For example, if my wife cheated on me and I'm not married, but let's say my wife cheated on me and I can't forgive her for doing it, I need to go to therapy to learn forgiveness. And if I can't learn it, or should I say if I'm not willing to forgive, she might have to move on because I'm going to verbally abuse her for the rest of her life because she went outside of the relationship, which she should not have done. But my point is there's some very serious issues that require professional attention in many of our relationships, okay? And without that professional attention, some relationships are going to be ended prematurely.
You know, that is so spot on, because I see when I'm talking to people about the intercultural, I used to refer to them like the cultural social institutions that actually the society depends upon to give it the stability that it needs, and everybody's in that institution is in it for grant money from old master, Mr. Charlie, who doesn't have the interest of the persons, the society, the black society at heart. Then the society is going to continue to be ill. And I've had these discussions with people that say we need to deal with the core of our issues, and then we will have the means to be able to fund our projects without having to depend upon grant money. You know, all these, some people, they're looking at the institutions that are out there that aren't serving the population, society, and they want to be like them. Hey, if I get a grant and I can do all these things. I'm like, you're not going to do all these things if you get your grant. Because if you get that grant, then you won't be able to do it. They'll take your money. And all these other things that happen, so then you're going to be beholden. You're going to be all fearful of losing the grant and under the they'll, you know, make all these excuses. Well, I have to bite my tongue. I can't do that program. I can't do this program because there's no money. Because now this so-called movement that they claim to be getting into, getting the grant money to tackle the program has really become an occupation, whereby not an occupation of liberation, but occupation of compliance to their oppression, you know.
That's right.
So, you know, and I've had discussions, you can tell when those persons do not want to let go of that vision, that they can just see dollar signs all in their eyes. Oh, if I can get the bourgeoisie guys to invest in me, they're not going to invest in you to save the community. But that lets me know that they have not studied and or they do not understand what's going on, and there's no way they're going to be able to even begin to assess black social ills if they don't understand how the society functions, how it got in this position, and the various means of eradicating these problems and tools that keep and maintain the current condition and worsen it. So,
right.
So how do we, you know, I guess we can discuss like the shift in the social paradigm to create these skill sets, you know, being able to help people understand that you need to see your brother as yourself, to see that you must love yourself and learn your history as important to having value in yourself so that you will create harmony with your fellow man or your fellow sister. You know, what are some of the exercises that we can engage in, by, you know, in order to develop these skill sets in the people who want to be conscious, in addition to facing their post-traumatic slave syndrome and doing the corrective therapies that you mentioned earlier? Could you please, I guess, share with us your insights on that?
Well, here's the thing. Sometimes our conscious defense to addressing an unconscious issue is so strong that we have to slip into the unconsciousness through the back door, Brother Charles. And what I mean by that is when you tell black people that we need our own organizations without white people, some of them are going to be totally taken aback by that. When you tell black people that we have to build our own institutions with our own money without any handouts, some of them are going to be taken aback by that. So what we have to do is condition them the same way white people do. White people do not condition you directly. When they influence your children to practice homosexuality, when they influence white men, black men to marry white men, black men to marry white women, men now too, unfortunately,
yeah,
they condition black women to believe they have a right to emasculate their husband. They don't do this through books. They do it through images and sound. They're very subtle. And before you know it, you're behaving and thinking in a different way because the teaching was unconscious. We have to do the same thing. That's the best way to unconscious a bunch of self-hating black people into consciousness of themselves. I think study groups is the way to go, Brother Charles, because with a study group, you're simply exposing them to the information and you're talking about it. And in leading the discussion, you're able to plant seeds in the minds of black people that sooner or later will sprout. For example, when I was Minister of Education for the Universal Negro Improvement Association, Marcus Garvey's group, the largest black organization in modern history. When I was Minister of Education back in 2005, a lot of people had a problem with race first. They said, this organization is only for black people. They don't accept white people. I can't accept that. And you know what I would say? I didn't automatically go on the attack. I didn't try to win them over in one day. You can't do that. We're talking about years of condition. I simply invited them to the study group and to the meetings. I didn't ask anything of them. Just come in here. And you know what? They started coming back. and started coming back on their own. And before I knew it, Brother Charles, they were asking for membership cards. I didn't have to do anything but expose them to the information. Why? Because through exposure, I am doing what? Subliminally conditioning them. I was conditioning them in an unconscious way where their conscious defenses were relaxed, they were not up, which gave me and my information access to their unconscious. In other words, I was able to plant my seeds, and the seeds sprouted, and they asked to join without me asking them to join. We have to use the same principles of psychology to win our people back that white people use to win them over. We can do it. The problem is we haven't even started.
Wow. And, you know, perhaps I should try harder because I've encouraged virtual study groups, but I think I'm going to have to try that in-person approach that you have just illustrated because it's like you tell, you know, you try to get a group virtual and say, hey, we're going to read a book, and a few of them buy it, and hardly anyone reads it, you know.
What I've done? Let me tell you what works with study groups, Brother Charles, because you know our people are not committed to their own information, unfortunately. So what you have to do is you have to give them small articles. Remember, you got to start them out with baby food. Start them out with baby food, then you give them solids. If you break out with a thick book from Dr. Ben, 500-page Black Man of the Nile, you're going to lose them. They're not used to reading nothing but the Sunday paper. So you start them out with baby food. What's baby food? You take articles, small articles. It might be from the Daily News. I use articles from New African, one of the magazines they produce in Europe. Is white-owned, I believe, but some excellent Pan-African articles that come out of there. I use the New African. I use some of the revolutionary white magazines here in America because they tend to have good alternative, you know, news information about the Bilderbergs and the Rockefellers and Obama's agenda and et cetera. That's all you do. And you let them read it in the study group. You read it right there. Or I read it for them, or we share and everybody takes a paragraph. That way I know what? Everybody's working from the same information. Because if only two people read the homework assignment and 30 people are there, it's not going to be productive because only two people can intelligently discuss what was read because only two people read it, which means everybody else's comment is going to take you off of tonight's focus. So the only way to keep them on tonight's focus is to let them read it right there. Give them baby food. A page. Read this article right now. We're going to take 20 minutes to read this by itself, or we're going to share read it, and then we'll have a discussion. Give them baby food. And after you've given them baby food for a year, now they can go a little bit. Now you can give them something to read outside of the class. And then if you see they're not picking up, you go back to baby food, and you tell them why you're going back to baby food. You tell them why, because y'all not reading, so we're going to go back to baby food. Now when you're ready for some solids, we're going to go back to the solids. But I'm not going to take you where you ain't ready to go. And that's why it becomes a slow build, Brother Charles, but it's worth it. It's definitely worth it.
Mm-hmm. So that's
remember,
the path.
Remember this, Brother Charles. Remember this one thing. And it's a psychological principle. You can only be guaranteed that your seeds are being planted. You can rest assured that anything that is exposed to the mind will accept it because it has no other choice. All seeds will be planted, yours included, white supremacy seeds, and every seed gets planted. So your confidence is in the fact that your seed has been planted. And after you've planted the seed, your work rests upon you watering that seed. How does your seed grow faster, stronger, quicker than the seeds that they're getting for white supremacy every day through the news and the radio and the internet? Is because you're going to water it more often. And because you're watering it, you know sooner or later it will sprout. We don't know when it's going to sprout. We don't know when it's going to sprout. But we know it will because that's the law of nature. All you can do, all I can do, plant as many seeds in the minds of our people as we can and try our best to water them and fertilize them. Because some of us plant the seed, Brother Charles, and we don't follow up. How many times have we ran into a brother or a sister, planted a seed, we had them hooked, and because of our own lack of discipline, we didn't follow up. So guess what? The seed never germinated.
Mm-hmm.
Stay with the seed. It has to grow. That's a law of nature. We don't determine when it grows. We only know that it will. I look at the children I work with, some of the youngest brothers who I never thought I could get through to, Brother Chuck. Never thought I said I could not get through this brother. He's a straight-up gangbanger. I tried. I couldn't grip. Guess who I see a couple years ago in college, working on his bachelor's degree, graduated at the top of his class, the same thug that nobody gave a chance to. And he saw me and stopped me on the street. I couldn't even remember his name. And he said, Brother Umar, I'm so-and-so from so-and-so school. I want to thank you for what you did. You saved my life. I thought I lost him. You know why
right.
I thought I lost him? Because I was expecting the seed to grow when I wanted it to grow. It didn't grow when I wanted it. It didn't grow till years after I had contact with him, Brother Charles, but it grew. So we can never, ever lose faith in our mission because the prize is worth it.
Wow. I mean, that has to be the most, you know, inspiring thing I've heard because I never heard a testimony like that before. Because, I mean, I share a lot of information, and, you know, I guess I don't have any insight that well, I guess, even though sometimes, you know, you get a lot of good feedback, but you just kind of want to know, how are they grasping it? You know, how is it helping? But to get that kind of feedback is something extremely valuable, you need to know that, you know, we can, the things that we're able to share is actually reversing the negative effects in the society of our people. So basically, we have to heal ourselves. It's our job. Nobody else's job to do that. And I guess sooner we drive that lesson home further and further, that it is your responsibility, my responsibility. It's we all have to corporately hold hands and link arms and read together to build and correct ourselves and get out of the idea that it's going to be somebody with a cape and some tights going to swoop out the sky. And well, one of the illustrations I use is kind of funny, but I tell people, I say, okay, even if that did happen, you know, just like in the cartoons or the comics, even when the hero does swoop in, they swoop back out. You still got to run the society. You still have to solve your problems, your day-to-day issues. You still have to be able to function. So, you know, nothing replaces doing those things that you just illustrated so clear for us today. Just revisiting this theme here about the social responsibility that we have in order to correct these measures that have, that have impaired our society. How do we address the social pathology of black organizations? And I guess another term that Tony Brown calls, he calls them the black unaccountable machine. They make themselves unaccountable to the community. They, we could say order us and say vote for us, vote for this person, vote for that person, you better do it. And then don't expect anything in return, and your compliance will be is mandatory. It's no. So how do we address these sociopaths that attempt to bully us, basically? How do us conscious folk, get the other people to understand that they're being bullied?
Well, number one, reason why our black organizations fail altogether or fail to bring in new energy is because most of them have a European ego-based model of leadership where there's one person at the top who knows more than everybody else and whose word is absolute law, and anybody who disagrees or any deep thinker who wants to constructively criticize the direction or initiatives that the organization is embarking upon, they're automatically marginalized, verbally abused, and ejected from the leadership or from the organization altogether. Most black organizations are dictatorships, nearly everyone. I don't know of a democratic black organization in the United States of America, and by democratic, I mean people are given the opportunity to express their opinion, to say what they don't like, to influence the leadership, and to influence who leads. I don't know of any, okay? I do not know of any of them, whether it's a church, whether it's an integrated NAACP Urban League, whether it's a Black Nationalist group, every last one of them are ego-based machines. And the reason why they're ego-based is because Black men and women, because we are not allowed to be Black men and women in the American social order, we are not allowed to show our true skill, talent, and capability. We come home and we are half-lived. You know, we have been, our intelligence has been incarcerated. And so what we seek to do, Brother Charles, is we seek to overcompensate for what white people didn't let us do. We seek to overcompensate for that in our own organizations. And so as a result of that, the Black man in his home and in his community organization wants to rule with the iron fist. The Black woman, whether she's at home or in her community organization, she wants to rule with the Black fist. That's why there's no democracy. That's why Black organizations have 50 people in them. Of course, when you have the ones that are ran on charisma, like, you know, the Farrakhan, the Jesse Jackson, you know, Al Sharpton, they have hundreds and thousands, but it's still not democratic. The people at the top are gods who know everything, and they basically dictate to everybody else. And you are not given an opportunity to question. You're not allowed to question those guys, okay? It's assumed that they everything they say and do is right, and that's not getting Black people anywhere. But they're not the only ones who are guilty of that. All Black organizations, most of them, are guilty of that. How in the hell do we get ahead where we don't allow our best minds the opportunity to shine? How do we not give our young Black brothers who are growing into men the opportunity to lead? How is it that the leader is 70 or 80 or 60 years old? That's ridiculous. When you study any society, the youth are always the leaders, but they are forced to take counsel with the elders because that's where the wisdom is. But you use the youth to lead. Why do you use the youth to lead? Because they are fearless.
Right.
They are idealistic, which means they are willing to fight and die. They are fearless, they are idealistic, and they have the ability to attract more youth. The future is in the youth. So the leaders have to be young because they have the ability to attract the youth. Farrakhan ain't attracting no youth. Jesse Jackson ain't attracting no youth. Al Sharpton ain't attracting no youth. The president of the NAACP, they ain't attracting no damn youth. Because they are old, but their egos are so big that they don't want to get the hell out the way. And so guess what? The youth are forced to do what? Start their own church. Start their own mosque. Start their own temple. Start their own organization. And whenever you have too many organizations, Brother Charles, and you can quote me on this, and I want your listeners to quote me on this. Umar Johnson said that when you have too many organizations that exist amongst a disorganized people. When you have too many organizations that exist amongst a disorganized people, you do not have organization at all. You cannot have a church on every other corner and claim the Christians are organized. You can't. You cannot be decentralized and organized at the same time. You cannot have a church on every corner and claim to be an organized Black Christian community. You can't have a mosque on every other block and claim to be organized. You can't have a Black nationalist organization on every other street corner and claim to be organizing. You're contradicting yourself. Because if there's 25 Black nationalist groups in the state of Pennsylvania and they haven't organized with themselves first, how in the hell are you going to organize anybody else?
Right. Right. Organization, and explain to people what exactly is organization, because they I mean, people have a concept of organization as just a group that does things, but, you know, talk about effectiveness, strategy, the ability to facilitate functions. I mean, when we're talking about organization and you could say alliances and that sort of thing to be able to get things done, ways and means of accomplishing objectives. Could you please elaborate on this organization concept for the listeners, please?
Stokely Carmichael, the late great Kwame Ture, who I think was one of the last sensei leaders we've had, who was a Pan-Africanist, he was a Pan-African socialist. He was not a Pan-African nationalist as I am. He followed W.E.B. Du Bois and Kwame Nkrumah. He did not follow people like Marcus Garvey and Patrice Lumumba, but nonetheless, he was sincere, although I disagree with him ideologically. Mm-hmm. He said that if you organize a little bit, you can get a little bit done. If you organize enough, you can get enough done. If you organize a lot, you can get a lot done. And if you get totally organized, you can get everything done. And I'm paraphrasing his words, but that's basically what he said. And his point was, the reason why black people ain't making no progress, Brother Charles, because there's absolutely no organization. We're not even trying to organize. Think about it, Brother Charles. 99% of the time when black people come together, they are coming together to pray, to protest, or to pass on information. To pray, to protest, or to pass on information. When was the last time you got called to a meeting whose sole exclusive function was to organize? And once you got there, they did nothing but organize. I can't remember the last time I went to one of those meetings. Every meeting is about the dissemination of information. Now, let me get something straight. I want to be clear, Brother Charles. We do need to disseminate information, because misinformation is one of the greatest wars being used against black people. My problem isn't that we're disseminating the information. My problem is learning the information has become the goal instead of the means.
Yes.
Information is a means. You use the information to go to war. You use information to build the institutions. You use information to construct industry. It is a means, a strategy, a weapon, a tool. It is not the end. That we have made information the goal. 75% of the so-called black conscious community is only conscious about learning more facts, reading more books, watching more DVDs. We have become a bunch of information addicts, Brother Charles. The crackhead is addicted to crack. The alcoholic is addicted to alcohol. And the black conscious community is addicted to information. We don't want to build. We just want to talk about the Illuminati. We want to talk about the latest conspiracy. We want to talk about what's happening with the children. We want to talk about the fact we ain't got no organizations. But don't nobody want to do a damn thing about it. We only want to share information. That's not struggle. That's not struggle. If I'm a general in a war and my informants bring me critical information about my enemy, them bringing me the enemy was not struggle. That's preparation for the struggle, Brother Charles. The problem is we ain't struggling. All we want to do is have the information. That's why we call ourselves a conscious community. We're conscious about what's happening. We ain't revolutionary, though. We're just conscious. Because to be revolutionary, you got to be trying to change. And if you're only trying to get more information, then you're just conscious. But I say that there's five criteria by which you should judge all black people: by consciousness, commitment, consistency, courage, and creativity. Consciousness, commitment, creativity, courage, and consistency. I don't give a damn how conscious you are. Milana Karenga is conscious. What is he doing? All your black scholars are conscious. What are they doing? Don't tell me you're conscious. White people are also conscious about the problems black people have. There's white people who are just as knowledgeable on Kemet. There's white people who are just as knowledgeable on slavery. There's white people who are just as knowledgeable about every problem we got in the black community. So the fact you're conscious don't mean a damn thing, because white people can be conscious about your problems too. What are you doing about them? And the problem with the information, Brother Charles, is that when we come together, even to share information, a lot of the information ain't relevant, Brother Charles.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the psycho-academic war, that's relevant. For example, 100% of our conversation tonight was totally relevant, Brother Charles. Everything you and I talked about for these 90 minutes, 2 hours, whatever it was, has been totally relevant. What's happening with our children is relevant. What's going on with black conscious organizations is relevant. Black male-female relationships, that's relevant. What are we going to do to improve the situation of the community? That's relevant. You are dealing with it. Our entire conversation was about what's going on here and what are we going to do now. But guess what, Brother Charles? There's other people who have radio shows, and all they talk about is what happened in Egypt 5,000 years ago. There's other people who have radio shows, and all they talk about is whether Jesus was right or whether Muhammad was right, or whether the ancient Africans was right. Okay? There's other people who have a radio show, and they talk about whether or not there's aliens living on another planet. There's people who talk about whether or not there's people living underneath the earth. There's people who talking about whether God is a woman or whether God is a man. Is that relevant for the here and now? What purpose does that kind of nonsense serve us right here and now? It does not. And that's our problem. Because not only are we addicted to information, we're addicted to information that isn't even relevant about what we're going through right here and right now. We are functioning under the strategy of escapism, Brother Charles. The religion
exactly.
of escapism. You know what escapism is? I'm going
oh, yeah.
to find some way to escape from my misery. I might
exactly.
use drugs. I might use religion. I might use UFO talk. I might use Illuminati talk. I might use Egyptian talk. But I don't want to deal with my problems. I don't want to use my money, and I don't want to risk my life. So anybody who tells me I can solve my problems by believing in Jesus or believing in Muhammad or becoming an African shaman, running to Egypt or relocating to this place or going over there or changing my name or praying this way, anybody who's going to promise me a get-free quick scheme, anybody who's going to promise me a get-free quick scheme will have my allegiance, because I don't want to do a damn thing to help black people, but I do not want to suffer myself. So if you tell me all I got to do is say Muhammad is God's prophet, or Jesus died for my sins, or I come from another planet, or I'm not African, or change my name, wear some locks, throw on a dashiki, pay some money, if that's all I got to do to stop being a victim of white supremacy, I'm going to do it. And that's why we got so many charlatans and so many hustlers in our community, getting rich in a conscious community, because black people do not want to fight to get out of their problems. They don't want to sacrifice to get out of their problems. They don't want to struggle to get out of their problems, Brother Charles. All they want to do is escape through some quick and easy, painless process of redemption.
You know, I've seen that. My wife and I have talked about ad nauseum, about how you can see people getting into these. They're like characters. They develop, it's like an alter ego, a persona that they take on in order to just be somebody else, and they live that fantasy. And like you said, they studied it. Like you look at the ancient history, and you're supposed to look at what those people used to solve their problems, how to look at the world, and adapt their skill sets to your own time, so that you can solve problems in the here and now. And what I found that you like you said, you see these people, they learn all of these facts about ancient places to some degree, because some of them don't even know the facts. But they learn some rudimentary facts, and they believe that is the object. It becomes into the showing off of how much they've, I would say, adapted into that character, how much they've assumed,
right.
They've dissolved themselves into this character. But okay, but those people lived in that ancient time, they solved real-life problems. They had to eat every day. They had to plant food. They had to fight wars. They had to deal with all manner of social dynamic. No different. They face threats no different than what we face, more or less dangerous than what we face in our time. And they've lost touch, well, like you said, with the idea of learning information in order to apply it to expanding the survival of your people, the advancement of your society, the ability of your people to gain, maintain, and expand the natural resources, because that's a true wealth. You're supposed to live on this planet and be able to do so abundantly. And if you're not doing that, you're not living abundantly, that's because we don't know what we're doing. Obviously, we are disorganized. It's obvious that we're being manipulated some kind of way. And until we use that, you're supposed to be looking at the ancient books and say, now, what did Hannibal do? He was crossing through the Alps. He ran to the Celtic tribes, and they did what to him? And how did he scale down the Italian Alps? And, you know, what did he do? We're supposed to be learning all the tactics so we can become tacticians, So, which means we're supposed to be the problem solver. The men in society, they say, the elders, we're supposed to be problem solvers. We get the vigorous youth to go out there and implement the programs, and they come to us for sagacity, for the wisdom. And we're not doing it. We're so busy, like you said. We escaping, we playing all our fantasy, just like the older white men. They go to the Renaissance fair and dress up, you know, in 15th century garments and run around and be crazy. And I guess in the black society, we dressing up in dashikis and calling ourselves whatever, but we're not translating that into our lives effectively. Let's just say that. What are your thoughts on that idea?
Well, I totally agree with you. See, here's another thing, too. We don't study the mistakes of our ancestors. We have this myth floating around that everything that was done in ancient Africa was absolutely correct.
Yeah.
That there were no mistakes, okay? If that were the case, they would have never been conquered by the Greeks. They would have never been conquered by the Romans. And they would not still be conquered by Arabs and Europeans today, okay?
Exactly.
So when I look at history, I study it politically. I don't study it emotionally and culturally, okay? I study it politically because I'm going to look at the mistakes of my ancestors to make sure I don't make them again. And the biggest mistake that our ancestors have made, and we continue to make it now, we have not learned it. We have allowed religion and spirituality to blind us. And to blind us from seeing our enemy for who he really is. That is our biggest problem. The mosque and the church are fundamentally integrationists. And because of that, they cannot see a white man as a white man. They have to see him as a Christian brother or a Muslim brother. Okay? What that does is that totally makes you vulnerable to their colonialism and conquering. Okay? We have been humane to a fault in our history. We do not know who to treat as family and who not to. If you notice, we do not, in the African tradition, there's no borders on family. That's okay when you're dealing with African people. That is not okay when you're dealing with non-African people because they will use your humanity to destroy your ass. And that's exactly what they've been doing since ancient Kemet, and we ain't learned it yet. Our problem is we fail to recognize that being dealing with God and dealing with spirituality and all that is necessary, but it's only half the puzzle. If you want to live on this planet as a man, you better prepare for war because that's exactly how they destroyed our ancestors, through war. And if we ain't prepared to meet the enemy, I don't give a damn how many mosques or temples or African spiritual places you build, we are always going to be under the foot of the European until black men and women realize that the only way we are going to be able to get back to who we were is to fight and die for it. And we don't want to do that. We want to pray our way out, politic our way out, protest our way out, pay our way out. And that ain't the way to do it. Freedom is through bloodshed. And Christians should know that better than anybody else because Jesus, according to their mythology, gave his life in order for them to live. So if you believe he had to die in order for you to be free, how in the hell can you believe that we ain't got to die for our kids to be free?
You're right. But obviously they have translated his lessons that they need to have a martyr. We have one leader. We sacrifice him into the enemy, and then the rest move on under dominate under oppression. But they didn't take the lessons when Jesus said, Yeshua, you need to take up a sword because you're going to need to protect yourself. See? And that the whole history of that people in Judea at that time was embroiled in war. And all these people we talk about, war. Like you said, doesn't matter how many temples you be, they're supposed to use the spirituality as a source, a fountainhead of strength from the heavens in order to facilitate their advancement, their survival. It is not supposed to be a crutch by which they just sit on the planet and lay back and eat until the enemy shows up with his army, and then all of a sudden, you know, all the paradise is over. And I guess, like you said, we have not learned that lesson and how you're supposed to use spirituality, the proper application of spirituality, because we have learned, in my estimation, that spirituality is an opiate. And because our oppressors have taught us to use spirituality as an opiate instead of a source of strength. And until we learn to use it as a energy source, then we will begin to, like you said, have the study the information as a means to the end, that is, come out from under the foot of oppression and tyranny and become masters of our own destiny. Until we learn to use spirituality and learn from the divine knowledge in order to throw off the yoke of oppression instead of using it as a means to escape the oppression into the self and thereby outwardly live as a zombie to the whip of an oppressor.
Oh, definitely. And see, another thing, too, to make this real simple, because sometimes I can over-intellectualize to a fault. For people who want it made real simple, I'll make it real simple. Black people suffer because they're scared of white people.
Oh, yeah.
And don't love themselves as much as white people hate them. And until we begin to love ourselves as much as white people hate us, we'll never be able to overcome white supremacy. Because the only thing that can stop a force, the only thing that overcomes power, is power of equal or greater magnitude.
Yes.
So if white supremacy is a power that's destroying black people, the only power that's going to be able to stop it is a black revolution that's filled with a black love that is equal to that white supremacy or greater in terms of power. And we ain't got there yet. See, we love to talk about white supremacy, but we do not love to talk about what it's going to take to fix black people.
Yeah.
You notice that, Brother Charles, most of the time when brothers and sisters get together and start talking about our problems, 95% of the conversation is on what they are doing to us.
Yeah.
Know why? Because nobody wants to talk about what we're doing to each other and what we're not doing for ourselves. Don't nobody want to talk about how we're spending our disposable income. You tell everybody, take out a sheet of paper, and I want you to write down everything you bought this past month other than pay the bills and buy food for your children. I want to see your entire expenses for the month. And if you see it, you will see that we probably wasted about $1,000 on garbage we didn't need. And if you got 10 people in that room, that was $10,000 right there, Brother Charles. With that $10,000, you could have gone and got a storefront. You could hook up with the black farmers and start selling fresh produce out of that storefront. With that $10,000, you could open up, buy a couple used cars, start a cab service in the black community, black-owned cab company, all the money comes back. See, the difference between what we're going to do for nationalism and what the Europeans do for capitalism is with nationalism, all of the extra money that's made goes into future projects. It doesn't go into anybody's pocket. But the problem with that, Brother Charles, is black people don't want to hear about not making no money because we are just as much hustlers as white folk are. We don't want to get into no struggle unless we're getting something out of it. So when you say what we're doing is for the greater good, they don't give a damn about the greater good. They only care about themselves, and that's another reason why we don't get nowhere, because nobody wants to get involved unless they benefit personally.
Right.
We are so selfish. We have learned everything that the white man has taught us to a fault. And it is his lessons. It is his energy. It is his core beliefs that are destroying black people. We're black on the outside, but we're absolutely white on the inside. You can fight the enemy outside all you want, but until you conquer the white man inside of you, you'll never be free. You can take the slave out of slavery all day, but until the slave takes slavery out of himself, he'll always be a slave. In America, you have free people, Brother Charles, and you have free people. You have F-R-E-E people, and you have F-R-E-E-D people. The F-R-E-E people, those are white folk who have freedom to do whatever the hell they want because they white. The F-R-E-E-D people, these are freed people. These are people who are free by virtue of the 13th Amendment. These are Negroes. And they're really not free, Brother Charles. They're only free to do the wrong thing. Oprah Winfrey ain't free to use her money to help black people. Bill Cosby ain't free to use his money to help black people. okay? Black people in high-profile positions, they're not free to help black people. They're only free to work against their own best interests. That's why you have freedom and you have freedom. Freedom, F-R-E-E-D-O-M, that's what white people have. Freedom,
right.
F-R-E-E-D-U-M-B. 40
wow.
million free dumbass Negroes who ain't got sense enough to know that if you don't make a future for yourself, you won't have one.
That is certainly correct. Wow, our people, like you said, I've articulated that to some degree in the past. How we, until we develop that love, that appreciation for the self that is equal or greater to the magnitude of hatred that the or European has toward the African, we won't be free. In terms of, like I said, in practical terms, the devotion to one's family and society, because that's the expression of that love that's going to repel all of the negativity coming from white society through black people, that, you know, those are double-minded, alienated Negro personalities of all shades and affiliations who project the hatred of white society through black people. And until we eradicate that psychological malaise, we won't be able to counter that. And so, like I said, we got to use this knowledge and spirituality as a means to the end, and the end is liberation, life, and that's what we do. What we do, defining liberation means having everything you need in abundance to provide a healthy, well-balanced existence for your people, to be able to have plenty, to not suffer lack, to not suffer injustice, cruelty, and abuse. That we have become, I would say, black people have become used to it. We think it's normal now. You see, I used to do like police brutality news. I kind of still do it on Facebook and on other social networks. And it was the black people were so bad that they were saying, why are you showing? They were ignoring all of these reports, that they didn't want to see. It didn't matter. And it's, I see it still happening on Facebook. Now it's become almost sensational. Oh, somebody else just got victimized. We got to learn to love ourselves and protect ourselves so that we will say, when this injustice is germinating, getting ready to take place, it won't be allowed. It won't be tolerated. You know what I'm saying? You will not. They will not. They only reason why they feel comfortable they can do this because they know they have successfully expressed through the black society that your children are have no value. Your children aren't valuable, so your society members have no value. So when we victimize them, you feel no outrage. You just say, "Oh, that's sad. It happened to that guy. Ooh, and glad it wasn't me." And everybody just moves on. And people just say, "Oh, I'm gonna stay out of it," like they got something else to live for. But
right,
like
you guys, we don't love our children any more than they do, Brother Charles. Black people don't love their children any more than white people don't love black kids. Black children see how we allow them to get treated. Our boys learn firsthand the power of white supremacy. They do not learn white supremacy from their parents. They don't learn it from the church. They don't learn it at the Boy Scouts. They don't learn it from their grandfather. They don't learn it from their big brother. Black boys learn white supremacy from white people themselves in school. If nothing else, you are taught in school that we run this damn place and it ain't a damn thing you or your mother or father going to do about it. They learn white rule firsthand. That's the whole purpose of public education, to teach your children that white people are in charge, have been in charge, and will forever be in charge, and it ain't nothing they can do about it. And that's why by the time black kids get out of high school in 12th grade, they feel powerless to do anything about the system because they have been so conditioned by white folks that they are meant to be gods, that white people are meant to be gods, that they don't believe there's anything that can be done about it. And that's why we have to build our own schools, because there's no way in hell you're going to create a revolution that's going to be fueled by minds that were engineered by your enemy. Those minds will automatically work against your best interest. And that's why we have more educated black people in America than we've ever had. more elected officials than we ever had, more doctors, more lawyers and engineers than we ever had, and we're in the worst condition that we ever had, because the black man has been taught to function like a white female, and the black woman has been taught to function like a white male. So while our educated black men and women are nothing but European robots whose job is to do nothing but copy the social life of their oppressors.
Right on, brother. Right on, brother. And as you have wrapped that up very clearly, I'd like you to give your final remarks these last few moments of our broadcast, sir.
Brother. Sure. Well, first I want to say, if there's anybody who's listening who needs to get in contact with me, if you need any professional consultation for one of your children or grandchildren, a child that you care about who you believe is being unjustifiably targeted for special education, unjustifiably targeted for psychiatric medication, unjustifiably targeted for juvenile incarceration, or unjustifiably targeted for school removal or expulsion, who's being unjustifiably referred for an ADHD evaluation or conduct disorder evaluation. If you have any paperwork that is saying something's wrong with your child and you don't agree with it, you can fax it to me. If you're interested in setting up a seminar, a training, a workshop, conference for parents, children, for the community, professional speaking is my primary job. That's what I do, in addition to being a school psychologist. Please feel free to get in contact with me. If you're on Facebook, you can request me on Facebook, Umar Abdullah-Johnson. I'm on Facebook under Umar Abdullah-Johnson. My phone number is area code 215. That's 215-989-9858. Again, 215-989-9858. My email address is umarabdullahjohnson@yahoo.com. No spaces, no underscores, one word. UmarAbdullahJohnson@yahoo.com. If I can be of any help to the Pan-African community, please let me know. I'll be speaking in New York City this coming Sunday, July 24th, at the Audubon Ballroom where Brother Malcolm was assassinated. I'll be speaking there at 4 o'clock. I'll be speaking in New York again next Sunday, July 31st, at Public School 154. That's the Harriet Tubman Learning Center. And the topic will be getting rid of this European state of mind. I'll be in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for Marcus Garvey Week. I'll be speaking with Mr. Garvey's younger son, Dr. Julius Garvey, Saturday, August 20th at the Marcus Garvey Celebration in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'll be in Goldsboro, North Carolina, August the 28th, Los Angeles, California, December 3rd. I'll be in Washington, D.C., August 14th for the Marcus Garvey Celebration. If there's any way I could be of any assistance to you, your community, or your family, please feel free to call on me.
But thank you, Brother Umar, and we appreciate you for all the hard work that you've done and your dedication to save your our people. And we hope to have you again on our program as soon as you can return.
Oh, thank you, brother. Thank you.
And we thank you, and you have a good, great evening.
You do the same. Peace and love.
All right, peace and love. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the African Conversations podcast.